Welcome to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak. Happy Valentine's Day. And coming up this Sunday is a fine opportunity for you to show your love for our magnificent but much degraded continent. This Sunday is the big demonstration in Washington, convened jointly by 350.org, the Sierra Club, and Hip Hop Caucus. And I just want to say this is a first for the national level organization. The office of Sierra Club said this is the first time we're going into civil disobedience because it's just gotten to that stage and we have to do this. Those three organizations are convening this protest demonstration in Washington to show citizen opposition to our government's pending approval of the building of the large XL pipeline, which would bring oil from the Alberta tar sands down all the way across the United States to a port on the Texas Gulf Coast so that the oil corporations can ship it abroad and make money. It has nothing to do, this pipeline, with our country's trying to achieve energy independence. We're still importing oil to meet domestic needs. And all this is happening at a time when every industrialized society on our planet needs to be burning less fossil fuel, not digging up new fields so that more fossil fuel and carbons will be put into the atmosphere to make the global climate crisis even worse than it is already in the process of becoming. Here's a message from Bill McKibben that was sent out by 350.org about this weekend's action. Quote, "I'm very glad to see leaders and celebrities standing up to Keystone, but I don't forget for a moment that it was 1,253 ordinary Americans going to jail who built this momentum in the first place. It's the tens of thousands who descend on D.C. this weekend who will push this to the next stage. We really shouldn't have to be put in handcuffs to stop Keystone XL. Our nation's leading climate scientists have told us it's dangerous folly. And all the recent Nobel Peace laureates have urged us to set a different kind of example for the world. So the choice should be obvious, but given the amount of money on the other side, we've had to spend our bodies and we'll probably have to spend them again. I hope you can share their stories from today. Each person participating represents a key part of this fight. I also hope you can come to be heard yourself this Sunday when we gather for our big action on the National Mall." Unquote. So for more information about this national action on Sunday and those stories he's talking about, or to sign up and say you're going to go, or to find out where the nearest solidarity rally is in your region, which will be happening simultaneously this Sunday, go to the website 350.org. And regular listeners will recall that we had 350.org's U.S. campaign manager on this program last month. Now, on a related note, I saw an article this past week about the big turnaround on energy that has taken place in Australia in just a few years. If you recall, when John Howard was prime minister up till 2007, the fossil fuel folks were clearly in control of government policy and just mocking, oh, didn't we give 3% to those renewable resource people? But since then, it's been a very different story. And this article I saw was reporting on this research from Bloomberg New Energy Finance. And according to their latest findings, electricity from wind power can now be supplied more cheaply in Australia than power from either coal or natural gas. And solar and other forms of renewable energy aren't far behind. Older coal-fired plants from the 1970s and 1980s still compete at lower prices than renewables, but only because their construction costs have depreciated. For the deployment of any new power generation in Australia, renewables now appear to be the way to go. And here's the bit about a carbon fee, folks. just like in Ireland, this one's working, although you'll see it says it's not even really necessary for this particular dynamic that's going on there. Australia currently charges polluters $23 Australian dollars per metric ton of carbon they emit. But the study concluded that wind power would still undercut fossil fuels even without that correction of the market's failure to properly build in the costs of carbon pollution. The study shows that electricity can be supplied from a new wind farm at the cost of $80 per megawatt hour, Australian dollars, compared to $143 Australian dollars per megawatt hour coming from a new coal plant. So they just go on to say that in Australia since 2011, the cost of wind generation has fallen by 10% and the cost of solar photovoltaics by 29%. In contrast, the cost of energy from new fossil fuel plants is high and it's rising. New coal is made expensive by high financing costs. The study surveyed Australia's four largest banks and found that lenders are unlikely to finance new coal without a substantial risk premium because of what they call the reputational damage of emissions-intensive investments, if they're going to finance coal at all. So this study expects both coal and natural gas to rise in cost over the next two decades. Among other things, coal power consumes more water, just like our fracking does here, than any other source of energy. And that will drive up coal's cost because fresh water is becoming scarcer due to the very climate change driven by coal power's carbon emissions. And in the United States, the article says, within the time frame of this study, there's evidence that the major proven natural gas reserves will peak out within the time frame of this study, rendering the boom in fracked natural gas in the United States decidedly temporary. Well, yes, temporary, but the poisoning to the groundwater is going to be permanent, isn't it? After they pull out and say, whoops, well, we made our quick bucks, bye. So anyway, I bring that to your attention because it's related to a trip that our guest took last fall, and we'll be hearing about that in a minute. I always find it very interesting when activists go to different countries and meet with activists, and what they discover is really fascinating compared to what gets into the media. Well, my guest today is Sarah Parkin. She's a founding director of Forum for the Future, a nonprofit activist organization based in Britain, which also has a satellite operation in this country. At Forum for the Future, Sarah Parkin has focused on the issue of leadership for sustainability. She's designed the Forum's pioneering Master of Arts degree in Leadership for Sustainable Development, and she also designed its Engineers of the 21st Century initiative. Both of these are in their 16th year now. She advises on science and society for the UK Research Council's multi-agency Living with the Environmental Change program. She also serves as a consultant in education and sustainability issues for a wide variety of organizations, including university leaders and senior NATO officers. In the recent past, Sarah Parkin has served on the boards of the Natural Environment Research Council, the Leadership Foundation for Higher Education, and the Environment Agency of England and Wales. After starting her working life in nursing in Edinburgh, Sarah Parkin has been an activist for sustainable development for over 40 years, including playing a leading role in the UK Green Party, and she served as co-secretary of the European Green Parties. I think back when there were about 17 of them there, I think some 27 or so now. But she was one of the overall coordinators of all those Green Parties. She has served terms on the boards of major British NGOs, including the New Economics Foundation, Groundwork, and Friends of the Earth. And she's a trustee of the St. Andrews Prize and a patron of Population Matters and the Museum of Isla Life on the Scottish island of Isla. She has written several books, including Green Parties, An International Guide, highly recommended. And she wrote a biography of Petra Kelly, whom we both knew. And that book is entitled The Life and Death of Petra Kelly. And in 2010, she wrote The Positive Deviant, Sustainability Leadership in a Perverse World, which is now used in many university courses. In 2001, Sarah was awarded an Order of the British Empire honor for services to education and sustainability. She also holds honorary fellowships of the Institution of Environmental Science and the Society for the Environment and the Schumacher Society. Plus, she's been given 10 honorary degrees. To sum up in one sentence what Sarah Parkin's life work has been, here's the way she puts it in her most recent book, Positive Deviance. Quote, "For over 40 years, I have campaigned for a great awakening from the fantasy that the natural world's capacity to support unconstrained demand from us humans is infinite." Unquote. Sarah Parkin, welcome to All Together Now.
Hello, Charlene. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, as I mentioned, I love hearing about what activists learn when they go to other countries and connect and observe. And before we get into talking about your work and your ideas, I'd like to hear about what's happening in Britain these days, first of all, regarding environmental issues, climate crisis, whether there's any greening of this slow economic recovery, and then what you found last fall when you went to Australia and New Zealand.
Well, here in Britain, it's pretty depressing. We're into, you know, what's now officially called the Great Depression, because really the economy is not turning round at all. Mm-hmm. And the government that we've got at the moment is taking a quite amazingly strong ideological approach to how it's dealing with this. And I was just reading an article in The Guardian today about all the efforts that are going into sort of demonizing the poor, accusing them of skiving and checking out on when people really have disabilities, whereas at the same time, absolutely no effort is being made to get in the taxes from the corporations and the very rich individuals
right.
who've offshored them.
It's the neoliberal approach.
Sorry?
The neoliberal ideology, right.
Yes, it is very, very strong about reducing government, reducing the public sector, and giving, as it were, a sort of free run to the private sector. There's been quite a lot of efforts to do this privatization in the National Health Service and in the education sector, and the kind of a dismantling of policy on the environment and other things. But we're beginning to see now quite a broad realization about what's going on, and not just a kickback from people, but it seems to have woken up our Labour Party, which has been asleep. So we've had sort of a fairly tough time of it.
Yeah, well, there are people over here like Paul Krugman, the economist, always pointing to Britain saying they did what the Republicans are pushing for, what you just said, a lot of cuts to the budget, cutting the public sector,
right.
And look what happens. They're going into their third round of the recession now, and he keeps trying to use this as a cautionary tale, but Washington's barely listening.
Well, I think it's a very important message, but one of the problems is that the idea that you can rekindle business as usual in the economy, nobody really believes that anymore.
Uh-huh.
And the Greens are arguing very much that you can, as long as the goods and services are green ones.
Uh-huh.
And then nobody really truly believes that.
Uh-huh.
But what is missing is the argument that actually it's not just growth in the activity of money, if you like, and the throughput of resources. What's needed is activity in the building of human and social capital and natural capital. And that's really where we need to be building a new economy, because to keep on doing it, even in green goods and services, is actually not going to work.
Uh-huh. Well, what you said about their privatizing a lot of education doesn't bode well for developing what you call human capital. Over here, that's just really slammed the door on so many people.
That's what's happening here. There's a curriculum review on the go at the moment, and I've just gone through it very quickly, searching for keywords, and it is a really narrowing the whole curricular options, not just on anything to do with sustainability, that word doesn't appear in the curriculum at all, but also on citizenship, very narrowly defined about knowing how government works and how to vote, nothing about the larger concept of citizenship and history, very much focusing back on our glorious imperial past. So it is. We're all pretty depressed by that at the moment, but I think there's going to be quite an interesting kickback, because already the Education Secretary of State has been pushed back hard by his colleagues and by an uproar about his attempts to change some of the exam system. So I think we'll see more of an opposition developing soon.
And then when you went to Australia and New Zealand last fall, what did you observe there?
Well, that's very much still a boom economy, but beginning to turn, because there is quite a lot predicated on extractive industries, but not as much as there used to be. The Greens hold the balance of power comfortably in the Senate, narrowly
in Australia,
by one seat in the lower house, and they've managed to get a Climate Change Act in, which is about putting a price on carbon. Business screamed beforehand, but has actually been quite quiet since it was passed, just getting on and absorbing it. And so they've had big fires, big problems with water shortages, and so I think the Greens are going to probably do quite well in the coming elections. Very interesting.
Yeah. And such a change over
New Zealand. I did less with the sort of national Greens in New Zealand, and I did talk to more local, and I was in Auckland talking to their city council, who really wants to take it on board but is struggling, and Christchurch, which was, of course, flattened by earthquakes, where their problems are as much social as they are environmental and reconstruction, physical reconstruction. How do you keep people there while you are rebuilding? So big challenges there. But it was very interesting, and I did a lot of workshops on certainly the book on how to actually develop yourself as a sustainability literate leader, how to apply the things we've learned from the engineering work we've done with engineers. So it was a very interesting trip.
Oh, great. Well, let's move into that, those ideas. Your most recent book is titled The Positive Deviant, and the subtitle is Sustainability Leadership in a Perverse World. And I love that, because, indeed, things have just not responded in the way 40 years ago we thought would happen to these very obvious and irrefutable arguments about the physicality of the planet and humans. But I want to give you one example of exactly how perverse this world is. A couple of weeks ago, the New York Times somewhat quietly announced that they're dismantling their environmental coverage desk in 2013. Yeah. You know, so by now, you think there would have been a whole section in the paper, or, as Thomas Berry always said, why don't they just put a state of the earth chart right next to the stock market chart? You know, market was up 13 points today, earth was down 16 points. But instead, it's just being erased.
This is right. But Charlene, this actually highlights quite a dilemma for the environment movement. Because there's quite a big current now that is arguing that if you care about the environment and you're an environmentalist, it means you don't care about people, and it's people first. And
well,
I think it's quite important.
That's manipulated by the other side.
Pardon?
I think that's manipulated by the other side. That's an offshoot over here. They right away, well, from 1980, as soon as Reagan got in, because there were a lot of Republicans and environmental organizations in that first decade after Earth Day. You can see them on the boards of directors, and it was seen as a nonpartisan issue. But after Reagan gets in and they start reframing it as, well, we could have environmental protection or we could have jobs. Which one do you want, people? So they always set up an opposition. No, it's either people or nature.
Well, that's exactly my point. And that is really being pushed now. And I'm talking about, these are naysayers, the climate deniers, they're people who want the status quo, absolutely right. And the environment movement here has certainly been pretty slow to get the connections, the interrelationships between what we want that's going to be good for people as well as the environment. So I think we have got quite a big, as it were, sort of communications challenge on our hands, because at the moment the argument that, you know, caring for the environment means your people are only of secondary interest.
It's not being challenged by us
as well as it ought to be.
My husband, who was the editorial director at Sierra Club Books, he said, listening to all this, he said, oh, I see, 40 years ago we should have named it the Human Environment Movement.
No, not at all. I just think we have
to be clever, there's not a difference in the poisoning. What poisons the earth poisons our bodies. It's all a continuum.
Yes, I know. I'm not under any circumstances denying that. You and I come out of the same sort of stable, as it were, from way back when.
Yeah.
And and the whole argument about being a positive deviant and sustainability, is it all of that interconnectedness? I'm just saying that we haven't perhaps articulated it as smartly as we could, which makes it easier for others to actually paint us as doing the wrong thing. We need to do what Bill Clinton did.
I see.
He put in a denial unit, so anybody who misinterpreted or wrongly interpreted or said things that were false, he immediately whacked in and made sure it was put right. Mm-hmm. We're not doing that as robustly as I think we ought to.
Right. Well,
it was Mark Twain.
One of the things I think you make inviting to people,
goals, they redoubled their efforts, and I think that's what you're seeing now.
Yeah, definitely.
Your pipeline, for example, is one good example.
Yeah. There's lots of ways they just really surged ahead, and we didn't. But I think one of the ways you make this
work
inviting
being done by Oxford University here, which is looking at the assets that the oil and the other energy, big energy industries have, and calculating just how many of them will be stranded assets, i.e. valueless. And that all these reserves that are being in the ground still at the moment are five times the energy budget, the carbon budget for the next 40 years.
That's right.
So these are essentially valueless. And getting that message over to investors is one of the things
they're trying to do a lot
of. Well,
they're valueless if the laws have changed, but the way the laws are in the United States, that's Bill McCabe's Do the Number campaign, that's part of that. Yeah, he used that research.
Yeah.
But, it's full speed ahead over here.
That's right. But I think it's quite interesting what's happening with investors, because another company that was going to do nuclear build in Britain has actually pulled out because they can't get the investment. So investment is, I think, key to being able to make the shift towards renewables. And your story about Australia, which is quite correct, actually the smart investments going into wind and solar.
Uh-huh.
Same in Germany.
Uh-huh. Hmm. Well, let's get into your ideas about leadership. Mm-hmm. I started to say I like the way you frame it in a very inviting way. Here's a line that caught my eye. Quote, it says, sustainability literacy is about having sufficient knowledge and understanding to make a good enough choice or decision. And then you go on and say, good leadership can decrease the severity of negative developments and increase the likelihood of positive ones. You will be brave in letting governments and organizations know what you expect from them, and you'll be no less ambitious for yourself and your neighbors. Your powers of persuasion, imagination, and example will mobilize ever more recruits to the cause of sustainability. What you do now, from now on, could not matter more. And then just this last little cautionary message you add, we will have to mobilize all our leadership skills to defend this new logic. Oh, it's unrealistic will be the most common objection you'll hear, but don't fall for it. Calls for reality are calls to lower your expectations. The counter question has to be, where will your reality take us? What logic is it pursuing? So arguing for sustainability means that if we want the ideal, we will have to strain very hard for it, aim high, and we might get most of it, if not all. And if we do fall short, it's likely to be good enough. But aim low, and we are bound to fail. Being asked to accept the realpolitik means bowing to somebody else's reality and to their profit motive, I would say over here. So, positive deviance, yes. How did you come to this term?
Well, I think it's because seeing the failure of governments and our multilateral in organizations as well to actually provide leadership, I came to the conclusion that we just have to get on and do it ourselves. I'm also really frustrated at how little really good sustainability literate leadership is getting into the sort of normal channels for developing leaders.
Uh-huh.
Of course, that's universities and business schools.
Uh-huh.
So from the experience in Forum for Future with our master's program, I just decided to write a kind of self-help book to encourage people to have a go. To know enough, have sufficient tools and different ways of thinking that they can try out, and to be confident that, you know, everything they do to nudge things in a different direction counts.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of people are frightened to do things because they don't think they know enough.
Mm-hmm.
So it's to give courage to people to just get on and do it wherever they are.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why that sort of language, and to sort of, as it were, sort of build individuals themselves as individuals, not as into some particular leadership model.
Right. And you don't mean it as, you know, people thinking, oh, well, leaders are people who head organizations. I'm here in the neighborhood. But you really mean this for everyone to jump in, as you say.
That's
and I'd
right.
like also,
well,
I saw another line. You said, if I had my way, no one would leave any publicly funded educational institution without being sustainability literate.
Exactly. Because the difference between sustainability literate leadership and any other is that, you know, ordinary leadership can be for an organization, for yourself, for a company, for a country, but sustainability literate leadership is for something far bigger than that. It's for all life on Earth, including us, the humans, and future generations. So wherever you are, whether you're in your own home or you're in a company or in an organization, your leadership is for something beyond your organization.
Mm-hmm.
So it's that sort of notion that I've tried to sort of express, and then be quite practical about giving people sets of knowledge and tools.
I want to talk about those when we get back from the break, but we'll have to pause now. This is
mm-hmm.
Charlene Spratnak on All Together Now. I'm speaking with my guest, Sarah Parkins. Welcome back to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spratnak speaking with my guest, Sarah Parkin. The website for the organization of which she is a founding director is forumforthefuture.org. www.thebookbarn.org. Now, before we get back into talking about your most recent book, The Positive Deviant, I noticed this quote from the Secretary General of the United Nations, Ban Ki-moon, in which he made a parallel between the economic crisis and the ecological one, saying, quote, continuing to pour trillions of dollars into fossil fuel subsidies is like investing in subprime real estate. Our carbon-based infrastructure is like a toxic asset that threatens the portfolio of global goods from public health to food security, unquote. That's very true, but I always get depressed when I see things moving in the direction of economic metaphors. In order to get through, we have to put everything into the metaphors of the market. So, alas. But let's go back here and take a look. You said you're providing people with tools for becoming leaders in their own communities, pushing things forward.
That's right.
With environmental wisdom. So these four habits of thought, what are these?
Oh, this is really the things that I use to think about what if I'm going to sort of make a choice or I'm going to decide. I sort of check it out and I say, well, is this going to add to resilience in the sense that it's going to make the relationships between people and the environment stronger? And the next one is relationships. Am I improving not just the number of interconnections, but the quality of them as well? And the other thing is reflections. Have I actually paused and have I thought and reflected about what may or may not have been done in the past and, you know, to take lessons forward so I'm not reinventing the wheel, particularly wheels that are going in the wrong direction? And finally, the notion of reverence. Am I taking into account that, in fact, the Earth is extremely powerful? It's probably unlikely that we can damage it before actually the damage to us is extremely great. Mm-hmm. So revering the power of the Earth and working with it rather than against it. So these are just ideas, just four ideas that I use to make sure I'm not just making a decision in a narrow context. I'm making sure it is related to other things, and wherever possible, I'm looking for collateral benefit. So if it's good for the environment, how can it be made to be good for people too? If it's good for people, how can you make it good for the environment?
Uh-huh. Yeah. Okay.
And many of the tools in the book are to help people think in an interconnected way about what I call building human capital, social capital, natural capital, and improving the quality of the built environment that we already have, because in many places it's a terrible mess. And if you think that we really focused in on that, plenty of jobs and a new focus for driving the economy, and the money will follow.
Right.
And you can look at communities where that's happening.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, there are a lot of...
My argument is that that's the foundation on which a long-term resilient economy will be built.
Uh-huh.
So there, if we can do all that sort of interconnecting by thinking very carefully about things, then we're more likely to get on the right direction quicker.
Right. Yeah, I think that's so right, to focus on rethinking the built environment and the way in which we do things. Well, I want to move on to another of your projects that I've always thought was so interesting, and I'd like you to talk about the MA degree you designed, because I think it's a model that could be replicated in many countries. So could you tell us about that one?
Yes, well, it's very much it's to try and fast-track young, enthusiastic, passionate people who want to do something that's going to contribute to sustainability, and to fast-track them through what it took myself about 25 years to learn the hard way, you know, by doing it.
Yeah.
And, of course, in my day, when I was 25 or so, nobody was interested in this. You had a certain amount of privacy, you didn't have that much reading to do, and you could just get on and learn all about it in privacy. But now anybody coming into this area, they're surrounded by a lot of information, a lot of books, a lot of websites. How do you make sense of it? So the whole degree is designed around helping them to pick through all there is about sustainability, leadership, ethics and values, economics, science, these are the sort of areas in which I had to do a lot of boning up on because I didn't know very much about it.
Uh-huh.
But critically, they go out on learning placements.
Right.
Into all sorts of organizations. So they'll go to big business, small business, government, national and local government, not-for-profits, the media, and they go there on a working learning placement. And they have
how long does that last?
They do four of those. Each of them lasts 6 weeks.
Uh-huh.
And there's 12 students, and they all go to a different organization, and they share the learning. We have reflective learning, group learning, experiential learning, pedagogy, and so they share all their learning, and through that they understand how these organized work, think, interrelate. So wherever they go, they can talk across sectoral and organizational boundaries.
Uh-huh.
And our graduates have found this one of the most helpful things is to have lost their fear through ignorance of how different organizations and companies and types of companies work.
Mm-hmm.
So that
and there have been some job offers just coming out of the placements, right? They were impressed with these young people who were there for 6 weeks?
Absolutely. And interestingly, many of them actually set up their own businesses.
Uh-huh.
So it's been the most thrilling thing. They've been wonderful because one of the things we do is actually we teach them entrepreneurial skills. So during the course, in groups of four, they have to design a new charity, a new business, or something, and then they have to make the case for it to potential funders. So they've got the skills
uh-huh.
to set up something.
Uh-huh.
And very often they get so enthusiastic, they actually go on and put into practice what they've done for part of their coursework.
Uh-huh. And so now, after 16 years, you've placed many of these graduates, or let's say they finishing your one-year
yep.
MA program and having these placements, by now they're in various levels of government and business and nonprofits, is that right?
Exactly right, or they're in their own business. And it's got
right.
so slightly amusing because when the government holds a consultation or it has a round table on something, it'll pull people from across different organizations and companies. And very often there's so many of our graduates
uh-huh.
in the room that they don't admit to being a forum for the future graduate.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Well,
you know,
it's one of the things I'm most proud of, really. It's been brilliant.
Uh-huh. Great. Now, the other one I don't know anything about. Can you tell us about this, the Engineers for the 21st Century Initiative?
Yeah, this is slightly more subversive and stems from way back in 1990 when I was fronting the Green Party
mm-hmm.
And was a bit more on the television than I am now. And
yes,
I was
sure
invited
were.
To talk to a large group of engineers at their annual conference.
Uh-huh.
And this inspired some of them and government to say, right, we've got to do something about engineering. So we took the route of getting young engineers who want to do something about sustainability, and we used the need of the engineering profession to attract recruits, because in Britain it's not an attractive profession like it is in the continent and I think in the United States.
Uh-huh.
And so we held a series of events.
What do you mean it's not attractive?
It's not viewed as being as attractive a degree as, you know, economics or...
You mean in terms of how much money they can make or stodgy field?
Yeah,
or what?
Yeah. They in Britain, they see their reputation as not being very good. So there's a real cultural difference between Britain and the rest of Europe in the way we view engineers, the status of engineers. A lot of it's their own fault, but I'm not going to go into that. But essentially what we did is we worked with young engineers, and this was really went down well. It got a lot of coverage, and we've worked on a range of projects in partnership with engineer employers and others and young engineers. And one of the most important things we did was working with the young engineers and the regulators of engineering. Now, if you qualify as a chartered engineer in this country, you have to demonstrate sustainability competence.
Hmm.
And that was really made a systemic change in the way education of engineers is taking place, and that's now beginning to trickle through, and most of our university courses for engineers now have that in it. It's taken about a decade, but it's really beginning to come through now. So it was one of the most subversive things I've done, and I really enjoyed it. And it's infected some of the other professions as well. It's a really good way of getting sustainability into what is the professional accreditation of different, like accountants. I think it's in accountants doing it now as well.
Oh. Do you see other professions in the UK being sort of greened, or is that not really happening?
It is beginning to come through. It's beginning to be expected that there is a knowledge and understanding of what it means. Because one of the things I do a lot, especially with the organizations that are not particularly warm to the notion of greens and think it's a bit woolly, I talk to them in the language of risk management.
Uh-huh.
You know, if you're not sure what climate change is going to bring, if you're not sure what environmental degradation is going to bring, well, you really ought to have, you know, some sort of risk management just in case it really does happen.
Uh-huh. And that gets their attention.
It's a good lever to get in.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. So, well, again, looking over all these boards you serve on and all these organizations, what are the hopeful developments that you see? Whether or not they can be replicated over here, I'm always looking for what's working where.
Well, I think one of the things that's happened now is that, you know, along with this view that you have to have more women on boards, that's really quite strong over here now. It's still a hell of a long way to go.
Huh.
But I think there's that feeling you need to have, that sustainability literacy as well. So you are seeing this now as being viewed as a sensible thing. To have is that understanding of sustainability. So it is happening, but it's happening too slowly, Charlene. It's far too slow. It's 40 years since you and I got going on all of this, and we haven't really come as far as we need to, as we know. So it needs to go a lot faster, which is one of the reasons I'm focusing very much on the education side of things.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. I remember when you said it's taken a long time to, just now you were saying, get this appreciation for why every board needs to have, say, half women on it.
Yeah.
I was invited to a conference in London in, something like 1993 or four. And I gave my presentation, and then it was time to take questions from the audience. And so I said, I'll just use this method that is common in the United States. I'll alternate calling on male or female questioners who have your hands up. And apparently that was such an affront to this distinguished theologian from Oxford with whom I was supposed to be on a panel in the next session that when I said that from the stage, he turned to someone you and I knew, the scientist Brian Goodwin, and said, I refuse to be on the stage with that woman merely because I said I was going to alternate calling on women and men so that men wouldn't hog all the space. But anyway, that was then, and I'm sure things are so different now.
Not enough. We've had 40 years of equal pay legislation through the European Union, and there is still not equal pay. There are still hardly any women on the sort of boards and making the decisions. And So it is a real problem. But the interesting thing is now, I think the new generation of women that are coming through are brilliant because they are doing this positive deviant. They're not even going for sort of subversiveness. They're going, we are equal. We are going to behave as equals. Mm-hmm. And we are going to, you know, just take our rights. If you won't give them, we'll just take them. Mm-hmm. So we've got this wonderful new sort of breath coming through of young, vigorous women who are not standing for any nonsense, and they're being very loud about it. Mm-hmm. So I'm thrilled to bits, and I just hope we can sort of emulate that a bit better than we are, but for the environment, for the environment. It's not so good for the environment.
Right, right. And did you see that kind of difference with the women when you were in Australia as well? It's a pretty macho culture.
I think so, because when I was there, it was just when Julia Gillard had turned round and really lost her temper in Parliament because Tony Abbott had been really the opposition, right-wing opposition leader, had been really sexist and calling her, you know, Bob's bitch. That is the Bob being the leader of the Greens. And,
Lordy.
Dreadful, dreadful language.
Alas, we're out of time here. I want to hear more about this. But
she let rip, and it was wonderful.
Well, I suppose we can Google her and get that story. I had no idea it was that
you
intense. Anyway, this is all the time we have. But Sarah Parkin, thank you so much for being on the program.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It was lovely.
All right. For the Arts Corner today, our poem on Valentine's Day is one that used to be quite famous in its time. This is by Dorothy Parker. And she was quite a well-known poet and writer in the 1920s through the 1950s, known for her sardonic wit. And she was, by the way, one of the founding members of the Algonquin Roundtable in New York for the writers of her day. And this poem is entitled One Perfect Rose. A single flower he sent me since we met. All tenderly his messenger he chose. Deep-hearted, pure, with scented dew still wet, one perfect rose. I knew the language of the floweret. My fragile leaves, it said, his heart enclose. Love long has taken for his amulet one perfect rose. Why is it no one ever sent me yet one perfect limousine, do you suppose? Ah, no, it's always just my luck to get one perfect rose. And for our song on Valentine's Day, after speaking with Sarah Parkin, we'll hear from another great Scotswoman, Annie Lennox. This is a song about what it feels like to be in love. Here's Annie Lennox, the Eurythmics, with There Must Be an Angel Playing with My Heart.
Playing with my heart, yeah. I walk into an empty room.
There Must Be an Angel, Playing with My Heart, by The Eurythmics, with Annie Lennox doing vocals. In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give 'Em Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. If you'd like to see who the guests will be for the next few weeks, go to my website, CharleneSpretnak.com, and click on the tab that says Radio. Join me next week when my guest will be Michael Brongart, co-author of Cradle to Cradle. He'll be joining us from Hamburg. Till then, this is Charlene Spretnak with All Together Now.